Okay, folks, we are at 7:30. Chris is suffering a bit in terms of his vocal range right now, so you're stuck with me to kick things off here. So welcome, everybody, to the February 18th version of the question and answer session for the Ottawa PC User Group. And we've got a whole raft of topics tonight. Some of them are quite short, so I don't know if we're going to get through them all, but we'll see how we go. Okay, so starting off, last week we were talking about income tax software, and there was a question, basically, what was recommended to be used with Windows 10, since Windows 10 is now at end of life, I guess. And it's that time of year, so let's have a little look at what people said. A number of different programs were at least mentioned, TurboTax from Intuit, U-File, StudioTax, which is an Ottawa-based company, and now there's Canadian Revenue Agency are in the game with their Simple File option on the web. And the final one, I think, was by Wealth Simple. So there was a lot of discussion in the chat window. One individual said they used Wealth Simple last year with Windows 10. And somebody else was saying that U-File, the cloud version, web version, I guess, is good. And somebody's been using StudioTax for several years with Windows 10, and it works very well at a cost of $15. And there's been somebody else using the Wealth Simple web. And then lots of discussion on TurboTax. This individual has been using it for many years, but the current version was rumored not to be working with Windows 10, even if you had the extended security update program in place to get security patches for Windows 10. However, this individual didn't want to use the web-based version, presumably from a privacy perspective, you ended with all your data in the cloud. But was asking if they switched to another program, could that information be transferred? And I'm assuming not, which is probably correct. And I think somebody said, yes, highly unlikely that you could transfer information between different programs. But that would be a neat feature. And then a follow-up on the TurboTax that they didn't recommend using, they recommended using Windows 11, but the Canadian version of the desktop system will run on Windows 10. And they were pointed to a frequently asked questions page for more information. And the other individual said this must be new. They looked at it days ago, and at that time it said Windows 11 only. But this was from an administrator's reply at TurboTax in August. But then the more recently on the downloads page, it says that they require Windows 11. So there was a lot of confusion. And the person volunteered to follow up. And down the bottom there, I've added the note that came in on the members forum, I think, that TurboTax is supposedly now going to work with Windows 10. And for some reason, if they don't update their web page to reflect that fact, and the support people said to ignore any warnings when you install the software. And even better, if it doesn't work, then they'll give you a refund. So, I don't know. Good luck for those people who use TurboTax and want to run it with Windows 10. It either will or it will not work. We don't know. And then, the CRA Simple File, so we suggest Googling that, and it can work for simple returns. Now, Chris had tried that, and he pointed out that it didn't really work for him very well, if at all, because there are criteria. Only certain people are allowed to run this web-based free service from CRA. And the criteria basically how old you are, where you live, and how much you make. And one of the issues is if you live in Quebec, you're out of luck because they don't, it's not supported in Quebec. But Chris had tried it for an Ontario resident, i.e. him, and decided he was a senior, over 65 years old. And one of the questions is, do you have an income greater than essentially $19,000 a year? And if you do, then you're ineligible. So, and it's even worse, Chris found out, if you're under 65 years old, the threshold goes down to under $13,000 a year income. So it strikes him and it strikes me that there's not that many people who are going to be eligible to use this simple filing system from Canada Revenue. So one would hope that this is just a pilot test, and one of these days it will be expanded to cover a lot more people. I actually took a look at this thing myself. I didn't believe Chris, but I just thought I'd take a look and see how it works. And quite honestly, I found it didn't make any sense. If you look at this particular question here, this is the one where they're asking about where your income came from. And you notice at the bottom, the answers are basically, yes, I earned income from one of these sources, or no, I earned income from other sources. And if you don't have any income, then you're probably not going to be worrying too much about filling out income tax forms. Anyway, look at these sources of income. So if you're young, you probably have a job, and you probably have a T4, and you're probably receiving employment income. So the answer would be yes. If you're older, you're almost certainly going to, well, if you're senior, you're going to be receiving an old age pension, and you're probably going to be receiving Canada Pension Plan benefits. So the answer to those two questions would be yes. However, and also the other one here is T5, the interest from Canadian sources. Okay, so bank interest and GIC interest and that kind of stuff. But what about if you have stocks and bonds? If you have stocks or you sell something that you own, like a cottage or something, you'll generate capital gains. If you have bonds, you'll generate dividend income probably. And so if you're having capital gains and dividends, then you're earning income from other sources. So if you're a senior with capital gains, the answer is yes, I earned income, and no, I earned income from one of these sources, and no, I earned income from other sources. So what do they want to know? Is the answer yes or is the answer no? It probably doesn't matter, because as soon as you look at the next question, how much you make, you're disqualified anyway. So anyway, I just thought that was a lunatic question. Somebody's not thinking about how you answer these questions. Final thing on the income tax, I'll just note this. Nobody else uses it, but I do. This is a program called Taxman. It's created by a chartered accountant in Victoria, BC, and he basically uses it himself for his own for his business. But he makes the system available to individuals completely free. Now, again, there are some limitations, and he doesn't cover certain Quebec forms. But the big thing is that you can't net file. And so if you're going to use Taxman, you fill out all the magic boxes, it will calculate your tax for you, but you then have to print out the forms and mail them to CRA. If you're happy doing that, it works really well. If you just want to use it to double check a different software product, or your own manual calculations, then you can do that, and you don't have to fill up, you don't have to print the forms and mail them. But if you want to do that, then it is actually a viable option to do your income tax completely free. Okay, anything, Chris, on the income tax follow-up?
There are a lot of comments, people saying what they were happy with and so forth. Be added in Genu, G-E-N-U, says it supports Windows 7 through 11.
Okay, let's carry on then. Good luck with your income tax, people. A couple of things that came in from Jeff Dubois. This is kind of a neat application called Text Behind Image. It's actually a web-based system. So what it does is it you give it an image and some text, and it will basically create the image with the text behind the actual image that you've given it. And it's clearly it's an AI type operation, generates high quality PNG images, and it's 100% free with unlimited downloads, no ads, and no sign up required. So you basically just log into the website, the URL is right there. And then there are four steps. You upload the photo that you want to use, the image. You add the text that you want to use. You position that text with respect to the image. It generates the PNG. You download it, and you're off to the races to use it however you wish. So here's the example that Jeff used. This is the image that he used, his Parliament Hill before the cranes arrived, and he decided to use the word Ottawa, and there is the text behind the image. So if you have any kind of application for generating images like that, there is a free online way to generate the image for you. Excuse me. Next up, Jeff has another option here, a Windows command that is a bit obscure, that generates a folder. He said it's a hidden system folder, and it basically lists all of the applications that are installed on your computer. So what you do is you bring up a window, use Windows plus R gives you a run command. And then you can type in the command you want to be shell:apps folder and press enter. And that will bring up this folder, and it will show you all of your installed programs, programs that you've installed, programs that are from the Microsoft Store, and programs that are part of Windows. And they'll all be shown in this one folder location. And now it's not an actual physical folder, so you can't really go to it. It's a kind of a virtual location. But it does let you see all of your installed apps in one spot. You can right-click on apps and make them into desktop shortcuts. And some programs, if you're allowed to uninstall them, then I guess right-click has an uninstall option on the context menu. And you can drag apps from this folder into other folders or onto the desktop to, again, create shortcuts. When you run the program, and this is the kind of display that you see, you get this applications folder, this virtual folder. See here, 3D Builder, 3D Viewer, those are, I believe, Windows applications. There's something to do with 7-Zip and Advanced Renamer, which are programs I've installed. And I don't know if there's any Microsoft Store apps there. I don't generally use Microsoft Store apps, but if you do, they're all shown in that one folder, and you can play with them as you're allowed, I guess. Okay, a couple of weeks ago, we ran a survey, and we asked what was the one thing that you wanted to know more about with respect to computers. And this little girl has a checklist of all the things that came in, and we're going through them now and again. So one of the things that came in was this one. This individual wanted to know more about mini computers, and these desktop little tiny boxes that fit on your desktop and have all kinds of USB ports generally. And they're usually a fully working computer, but basically very tiny. I believe they're fairly energy efficient and relatively inexpensive. Now, the problem is Chris and I, neither of us know anything about mini computers. So if you know about mini computers or you'd like to research mini computers, if you have a mini computer and you'd like to tell people how well it works or how well it doesn't work or why it's such a cost-effective way to buy a computer, we'd love to hear from you, and the group, I'm sure, would be very interested in your thoughts on this particular device. So there's a heads up. Anybody who wants to create a share on mini computers, there are various people who are interested in the results of that. Two of the other responses to the questionnaire were Linux and how to transition away from Windows to Linux. And if you do that, what's the suitable distro to start with? Now, it turns out that I do know a little bit about the answer to this question, so you're stuck with me for the next few minutes. I have actually been trying to convince people for a number of years that they should think seriously about using Linux. And at one point, I was seriously looking at how would I get away from Windows altogether and go to a completely Linux-based computer system. So I came up with this series of shares on Q&A in fall of 2021, and ran it through the spring of 2022, where I was talking about preparing to abandon the Windows ship. So I went through all of the things that were pertinent to the way that I use my computer, how I could use Linux to do the same kind of things, or maybe do things slightly differently, some of the pros and cons of Linux versus Windows, and whether it was actually possible to move away from Windows completely. And in my case, it really isn't. I've got a couple of things that I do that really do need Windows. One of them in particular desperately needs Windows. It's the only way to run the particular program. But, you know, there are certainly a lot of things you can do with Linux, and you're not necessarily tied to only having to use Linux. You can use both. And certainly I tried to cover that in this series of articles, which were basically brought on by the Windows 10 end of life. Initially, it wasn't clear whether Microsoft were going to do anything other than close Windows down. So now I really was looking at, my computers would not upgrade to Windows 11, my current computers. I was unwilling to go out and buy a new computer when I had perfectly good, in my opinion, perfectly good hardware. So I really was concentrating hard on how could I, rather than trade up to Windows 11, which I couldn't do anyway, other than by buying a new machine, how could I trade up to Linux? And so I had this series of newsletter articles, one a month, starting in September 2010, that's 1 year before end of life, and finishing up in September 2025, which was a month before Windows end of life. And if you want to check out those articles, it goes through all of the steps that you need to install Linux, how to dual boot, and then the various systems that Linux has that are similar or different to Windows. All of the newsletters, all of the articles are available on our website. And here's a big shout out to Bridget Lord. Bridget is our newsletter editor, so she does a sterling job every month putting together our fabulous newsletter. But Bridget is also our webmaster, so she also looks after posting all these newsletters on the website and makes them available to you for archival purposes. So thanks, Bridget, for everything you do there. All right, so that's kind of the history of my involvement in trying to promote Linux within the club here. But let's just think in terms of Linux in general. And we talk about Linux, and there are kind of two parts of Linux, if you like. One is the actual Linux kernel. That's kind of the engine that drives your computer when you're running Linux as an operating system. And it's kind of the big black box in the background, managing all of the system tasks. It times and schedules the various multitasking operations, and it handles input-output for all the different devices that we use, and looks after security and things like that. All of the operating system type stuff. So that's really Linux in its raw format, if you like. But we also talk about Linux when we really mean a Linux distribution. Because now what you do is you take the Linux kernel, which is the actual operating system, and you bundle it with a whole bunch of programs, utility programs, user applications, things like file managers, text editors, office suites, web browsers, an email client maybe, a media player, things like that. And when you put all of those different pieces of software together on top of the Linux kernel, then you have a Linux distribution, which Linux heads call distros. So you have a number of Linux distros which are available. Now, if you go to distrowatch.com, which is kind of the ultimate resource for different Linux systems, you'll find that they list more than 1,000 distributions. Now, that includes active distros, and it also includes ones which are currently dormant, like nobody's actively developing it further these days, and also things that have been dropped, so discontinued Linux distros. And amongst that 1,000 plus distros, there are also some BSD variants, which is a Unix type system, which is very like Linux. It's free and free software again, and it's Linux and BSD are both variants on Unix essentially. However, if you just consider the active distributions, there are almost 400. When at the time I looked at this, there were 399 active distros listed on DistroWatch. And that gives all kinds of headaches to various people. So the question is, the question is, why are there so many distros? And the answer is, well, Linux is open source, and Linux applications are typically open source. So that means that anybody can take the Linux kernel, they can take the Linux code if they're a programmer, and they can change it and release it as a fork. But they can typically take the kernel, they can take various applications, and they can release their own distribution. There's nothing to stop anybody doing that because of the open source licensing. There are also multiple people and organizations developing distributions. So you've got corporate entities that generate distros. You've got community organizations, loosely formed generally, that create distros. And even individuals will create individual distributions. And what that means is you've got a wealth of different kind of distributions. So some distros focus on Linux beginners, and some distros are aimed at people who are experienced with Linux, advanced Linux users. You also have distributions which are designed for an individual PC, a desktop or a laptop. Or alternatively, you have distributions which are specifically for running network servers, web servers. So you've got different distros for different people and different purposes. And you've also got all these developers, they have their own philosophies. Some people think that a distro should have long-term stability, so they have point releases. They release their version of Linux, and then they set about working on the next version in the background, and they they squirrel away all the stuff they need. They work on upgrades and bug fixes, and they generate a new version, and then they release another point release. So you get these releases which are available for relatively long periods of time, months to years typically. The other philosophy is, well, we want the cutting edge technology, whatever's available, experimental, new features, whatever. We want that like right now. So that becomes what they term a rolling release. As soon as the technology is available, it gets pumped into the distro, and the distro gets updated as a new release in this rolling release cycle of this particular distro. And the other different philosophies are, well, what file system shall we use? And there are various Linux file systems, just as there are various Windows file systems. You think of FAT, FAT32, XFAT, NTFS. Well, Linux has its own series. It has the XT3, XT4, ButterFS, ZFS, all kinds of different file systems. And also different software repositories and different package managers. So different development teams will adopt different strategies as to how they bundle their software. So now the question is this a good or a bad thing that we have so many distros? The answer, as always, as Chris would say, that depends. If you've ever only used Windows, then trying to choose from 399 Linux distros, it can be overwhelming. You may be choice paralyzed, as they say, and not be able to make a decision because there are so many choices, you don't know which one to select. But by the same token, on the other hand, people who are experienced with Linux, they may look at all these distros and say, wow, this is great, there's all kinds of different levels of control here. I can have complete control, or somebody will look after the really hard stuff and I only have to customize various bits of it. And you've got all kinds of different ways that you can customize things. So you can pick and choose which distro best suits your needs at any particular point in time. And of course, the good news is because Linux is free and open source, then you can experiment with all these distros at basically zero cost, other than the time it takes to download, install, and experiment with all these things. However, if you're a new user, you might want to think more in terms of mainstream type things. So what would we consider to be the main Linux distros? And I would argue there are probably three. Debian is an old established Linux distribution. They go for the stable release, the long-term support type program. So this is not a rolling release, but a point release type system. And Debian is a distro by itself, but it has also spawned variants. So Ubuntu Linux is a variant of Debian, and Linux Mint is a variant of Ubuntu, which is a variant of Debian. So these are related cousins, if you like, of Debian. If you go to the cutting edge side of the world and want a system that has a rolling release, then probably the archetypical distro for this is Arch Linux. Arch Linux is considered to be probably only useful for experts. It relies heavily on the command line generally, and so it's generally considered to be an expert type system. But again, it has generated somewhat more user-friendly versions of Arch. Manjaro Linux is an example. Endeavor and Catchy are also these variants of the Arch Linux distribution. And then you have Red Hat Software. you're probably familiar, you might not be familiar with Red Hat, but you may have heard of Fedora. Well, Red Hat is a company that got into the business of trying to sell Linux, and they decided that their model was going to be that they would give away Red Hat Linux, but they would then sell support. I think now this may be a commercial operation now. Red Hat Enterprise Linux is clearly designed for use by businesses, large organizations typically. But again, there are these spin-off projects, and I mentioned Fedora, Rocky Linux, and Ulma Linux are community-type distributions of Red Hat-based software. They're probably the main players, if you like, but there are all kinds of others. Slackware, you may have heard of, it's now the oldest surviving, actively maintained Linux distribution. Gentoo, again, has been around a long time. It probably is for advanced users. Generally, people who use Gentoo will build stuff from source, including building the Linux kernel from source and all the applications and utilities from source. So that's not a thing that a beginner in Linux would want to undertake. SUSE and OpenSUSE are kind of like Red Hat. They're based in Germany, but have worldwide usage. And again, they have both enterprise and community versions of their distributions. And there are lots of others. Those 399, there's all kinds of different ones there. Lots of people developing new things, looking at lightweight designs, advanced features, different package management systems. And one of the players is called Alpine Linux, which is a lightweight Linux distro, which is actually being used to generate a version of Linux, a mobile Linux, for smartphones and tablets. If you're interested in this whole business of the number of different Linux distributions and how they came about, this YouTube video is basically the way to find out more. It's I think it's about 20 minutes, but it goes through a lot of the stuff I just talked about in a lot more detail and with a lot more examples. All right, so if you are just a Windows user and you're interested in thinking about Linux, trying Linux, then where are you going to start? Well, one of the things you can do is these days, you can just ask a chatbot, or maybe one or two chatbots. Ask it, which distro would you recommend? And here I said, for a Windows 10 user with no prior Linux experience. All right, so you've been using Windows, you haven't used Linux, what would you recommend? So here are the three answers. ChatGPT said Linux Mint Cinnamon Edition. They said it's the most natural step from Windows 10, most Windows-like, if you like, with minimal headaches. Perplexity AI said, Linux Mint Cinnamon Edition, the top recommendation for a Windows 10 user new to Linux. Microsoft Copilot, just for change, Linux Mint Cinnamon, the easiest, least frustrating, and most familiar starting point. So that's kind of what I've been saying for a while, is if you're a Windows user, Linux Mint is probably one of the distros which is most Windows-like and is therefore probably easier to get to know and use. So if you're interested in trying that, here's the URL, linuxmint.com. The latest version is, the most recent version is 22.3, which is Xena. And there are various flavors of that, but again, I would recommend the Cinnamon Edition because it does have a desktop which is very much like Windows. And if you want to know how to do it, then here's a couple of URLs from my Linux North blog. First of all, how to create a live USB and how to run Linux Mint from that USB. so you can actually try Linux without having to install anything on your computer. But if you do want to install Linux on your computer, then you can do like I do. You can install Linux Mint alongside Windows 10. So you'll have Linux Mint as a dual boot system with a menu, a boot menu, which will allow you to choose either Linux Mint or Windows 10. So if you get into trouble with Linux Mint, you can always go back to Windows 10. Or if you're using Linux Mint as kind of a daily driver, but then you need to use Windows for a very specific application, then you can just boot into the other side of the box and use Windows 10 instead of Linux Mint. And the Association of PC User Groups, I think that's what it's called, APCUG, I gave this presentation, Dual Booting Windows and Linux, back in October. And just recently they've published the video on their YouTube channel. So if you want to hear all of the things I've just spent a long time talking about, again, with pretty pictures, then you can take a look at that video. Okay, I'm spinning this out so Chris doesn't have to talk very much. But
okay, we'll get tons of stuff in the chat. I highly recommend anybody has any interest in Linux, make sure you check out the chat. In particular, I pull out a couple of things. Tristan says apparently there's a new Linux application called Winboat. I don't know if he means distribution, that can run Windows-based applications. And he pasted the URL to that into the chat.
I think that's the kind of a version of Wine, so you can run Windows apps on the Linux platform.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, he says that can run Windows-based applications. Interesting, yes. Ken gave a URL to distrochooser.de, so Deutsch, but it's in English. I went to the website, and that looks interesting because it takes you through a questionnaire where it says, you know, how do you use it and some things like that. So to help you choose out distribution, it might be useful. Corinne asks, Alan, do you contribute to one or more distros?
No, I don't.
You've provided feedback though, right? When you run into issues.
I've done the bug reporting type system.
Yeah.
I must say it works a lot better in Linux than it does on the feedback code for Windows.
Yeah. The last one that I pulled out as being particularly interesting, I guess. Harvey asked, does Apache Server run on a particular distro? And Tom actually replied saying it'll run on all distros.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Yeah.
So, again, there's lots of more information in the chat. So if you have any interest in it, be sure to check that out. It will be posted on our website. If you don't grab it here, it will be posted on our website probably later on this evening. And that's the main stuff.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. So, Chris, the next item is yours.
Okay, so keyboard shortcut number 3. So this is in the computer basics, and I figured that this is something everybody could use. Rather than using your mouse and menus on the screen, it can be a lot faster to use keyboard shortcuts. So today's shortcut is delete by word. So everybody pretty much knows that if you use the delete key, it'll delete letter to the right of wherever the insertion cursor is, letter by letter, each time you hit delete. And if you use the backspace key, it'll delete the letter to the left of the insertion cursor, letter by letter. But if you want to delete faster, how about deleting by word? So if you do a control delete, it'll delete the word to the right of the insertion cursor, and every time you hit it, it'll delete the next word. And if you do control backspace, it'll delete the word to the left of the insertion cursor, and each time you hit it, it'll delete another word. And that's keyboard shortcut number 3.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Okay, next up we have an item from Steve Parker. He notes that if you have email messages in your Gmail account and they have attachments, it can take up a lot of your disk quota space. Typically, you know, a simple email text-based system are very small. But if somebody sends you a four megabyte image or a 20 megabyte video, If you keep these things around, they can suddenly eat up a lot of your disk space. And if you want to free up the space, then one of the things you can do is just delete the emails. But that means that you don't have the actual text anymore. You can't search it, you can't reply to it, because you just deleted it. So he points out that Google actually has an application called Attachment Manager. And essentially what it does is removes the attachment. So it recreates the email without the attachment and then deletes the original that had the attachment. However, he notes here the caution: if you need to keep the attachment, then save it to your computer manually before you actually run this Attachment Manager option. Somebody have a question there or a comment?
No, I don't think so, and I apologize for coughing and not muting myself.
Well, that was you. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so thanks, Steve, for that. Anybody who's running out of space on their Google account, that might be one thing that they might want to take a look at. Just save the attachments locally and then just get rid of the attachments. Karen wants to know, will it leave a note on the Gmail message that the attachment was removed?
Alan, can I add one thing to that?
You can answer that question too, please, Chris.
No, about the attachments for the Gmail. It's not the same as the workspace. It's part of the border on the right side of the Gmail window rather than the waffle menu. So you have to make sure you go to the right area. There's actually two separate channels that you can use to install programs on Google.
And okay, Karen's question was, will it actually leave a note in the email itself that there was an attachment that had been removed?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, nice.
Okay, all right, thank you very much. Okay, we had a question came in from Ollie, and she said this: if and when she purchases a new phone to replace her old Galaxy, what does she need to get it up to speed and running? So, Chris put this slide together. He says, what did you do the last time you upgraded your phone? Did you have a process that transferred all of the data and the account information from the old phone to the new phone? And if you did, was this a manual system or was it automated in some way? What did you do with your old phone? If you sent it off to e-waste, did you wipe any sensitive data before you did so? And are there any other considerations which you're thinking about? So if you have answers to all of those questions or any of those questions, you want to send it into the chat window. We won't get around to it tonight. So send us an email, suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we'll take that under advisement for next time. However, I can tell you what I did last time I upgraded my phone. First thing I did was to record all of the information about the new phone in a maintenance log file. I always do this for new devices, computers, phones, tablets. The make and model and the serial number and, you know, anything else that I think is of interest. I just point out down here, I made myself a note that Samsung was only going to support this phone for 4 years. So that was in 2021. So it's probably expired now. I'm not getting any security updates anymore for that phone. And I also have information here on the SIM card, the cell phone, the password, the Google account that I had to use to set up the phone. And you notice here I entered my date of birth very carefully as the 1st of January 1960. I'm sure that's correct because you have to enter that accurately, don't you? Don't they demand that you put in all the accurate information? So I'm sure my birth date is the 1st of January 1960. And then the information about my Samsung account. Oh, Corinne says we share the same birthday. Happy birthday, Corinne. And then the final, well, not the final thing. The next thing I do is to install all of my applications. So I go back to that maintenance log, take a look at all the applications I've installed, and then go out to Google Play Store and download all these things and install them. So I'm ready to go with my new phone, except I did transfer my contact information. So if you go to, on the old phone, if you go to contact and settings, which is this, on my phone, it's this hamburger menu here, the three horizontal lines. And then that brings up a menu where I can choose manage contacts. And that brings up the option to export the contacts from my old phone to a transition file, and then I can just take that file over to my new phone and use that and import contacts from that file. So that's some manual work there to install the applications, and some automatic work essentially by transferring the contacts using this built-in feature to Android. I noticed somebody said that he sold his phone, his old phone, somewhere or other. I actually kept my old phone, and here it is. And you may notice that it's now booting into PostMarket OS. And PostMarket OS is a Linux distribution, a mobile Linux distribution, designed especially for smartphones and tablets. So at some point, I'll have a presentation on how to install Linux on smartphones, I think. Anyway, we'll see how we get on with that as we go along. Wayne sent us a share on a program called Quick Installer. And this is a bit like, what's the thing we use here? Something My PC. Update My PC.
Hatch My PC.
Hatch My PC, right. It basically looks at all the programs which are installed on your program, on your computer, and then will look for if updates are available.
Or WinGet.
A big one?
Or WinGet.
Or WinGet. Yeah, okay. And we'll download and install the apps. So this will install any software that has in its database, so that's a limitation, I guess. However, Wayne says there are more than 1,000 applications available in this database. So it scans your applications, checks for updates, and tells you if there are any newer ones, and then it will allow you to keep your software up to date. And you can also export a list of the applications which are installed. And there's the URL if you're interested in it. And this is the actual screen, and you notice up here that there's an update available for Calibre, which is an email reader, and then down here for Fastone Image Viewer, which is a freeware digital image management system, essentially, it's currently available. So if the update's available, you can check and you can update. And if it's currently unavailable, you're also allowed to submit. So if the thing, if you have an application on your system that isn't in the database, you can choose to submit it for inclusion in the database. You have to log into their site, submit the details of the program, vote on the submission, and then the developer, and it's an individual developer who generates a quick installer. He then has to verify and test your application before he will actually include it in his database. So that can take a bit of time because he gets multiple submissions and he's on his own doing this stuff. But there's an alternative to things like Patch My PC if you want to try out automatic updates for your applications. Boom. This question came in about Hotmail, and I don't know anything about Hotmail and Proton Mail. So this is a question for everybody out there. The member here is using Proton Mail, sent a message to a Microsoft Exchange server, which bounced because it timed out. But when she clicked on it, all her Hotmail messages suddenly appeared. So she ran Outlook to see what was going on, and all the messages appeared there without having to enter a password. She checked with Perplexity AI, and that suggested that this may be Windows 11 automatically synchronizing message systems. Google suggested that maybe Windows Update had caused these previously Outlook messages to be downloaded once again. But the question is, since I don't know, has anybody else seen the same issue, and do you know a fix? So again, if you have any thoughts along those lines, if you want to send us a suggestion, we'll do a follow-up next week. And a similar question about Outlook. This member has PST files from Outlook Classic that he really likes to be able to search and read the messages, print them if he wants to. However, he doesn't have Outlook Classic. Apparently, has been discontinued, and he doesn't have the program. He tried a package, that a Chrome extension that Chris had talked about in 2024, but that didn't do the job completely, I guess. And then he looked at an Ask Leo video, which seems to be transferring mail from PST files to Thunderbird, which is an email client, and he said he'd like to do that, but chicken and egg, he needs the Outlook Classic program to be able to do the job. So the question here is, does anybody know of a workaround for accessing PST files without having Outlook Classic available? Or alternatively, do you know a source for Outlook Classic? Here's a contribution from Stuart, and you'll notice here I put Stuart's comments into his suggestion. Cdocs is a web-based a text editor, text processor, which is a Canadian product. It's a kind of a Google Docs clone, if you like. It's being generated by this Canadian operation. Stuart says it's free for now, and he says that's in the works. However, there's a current limitation, which is a 50 megabyte limit on disk storage. So if you just have simple text documents, and not very many of them, I guess, that might not be a problem. But if you have long documents, or if you have, you know, high-res graphics that you want to embed in the document, then the 50 megabytes may be going to fill up fairly quickly. Anyway, that is a Canadian option if you want to try that out and provide some feedback to the developers. Maybe they'll do exactly what you want. here's a video, a YouTube video, which I came across, talks about Windows 11 forcing changes, and basically what he's really talking about here is I got my chat window. What he's really talking about here is that forced upgrades for Windows 11. He contends that these are not about security. It's really about Microsoft trying to take control of your system. So the guy should have a little tinfoil hat. I guess this is the conspiracy theory type thing. So it's interesting to listen to, but whether I believe it or not, I don't know. To some extent, I think there's a grain of truth in there. I mean, Microsoft always forcing things on users, whether you like them or not, And generally, they make these things optional, which is the one thing about I like about Linux is they make changes, but they generally make things optional. So you can always go back to the way things were. Anyway, if you want to do the conspiracy theory about Windows 11, then there's the video for you. Interesting thing I came across recently, if I can change my slide here. There we are. Hit a key. That will do it. I looked at my desktop, and I hadn't updated it for a little while, and it told me that I'm not up to date. However, it also said that my device was missing important security and quality fixes, and it's in red, so that must be a serious concern. However, if I hit the gray check for updates button there, it goes away and it thinks for a little while, and then it comes back and it tells me exactly the same thing. It doesn't offer me any important security updates and quality fixes. It just tells me my system's not up to date and I'm missing all this stuff. And if I run the Windows troubleshooter, then of course it can't find anything wrong as usual. So I decided I'd go and ask Microsoft Copilot. Microsoft Copilot AI, it should know what's going on. So I asked it what's going on. And it said that that up-to-date message is one of the most misleading parts of Windows 10's post-end-of-service, end-of-life behavior. Most misleading parts. And a bit further down here, you'll notice that it says, once Windows 10 reached end of support, end of life, Microsoft hard-coded the update program to display the banner for all non-enterprise, i.e. home user, systems which had enrolled in the extended support updates program. Even if your entitlement was valid, updates were already installing, or if your system was fully patched. So that was a built-in banner which was hard-coded into every Windows 10 system that's got ESU support. And so the question is, was that a blunder? Was the blunder hard-coding the banner, or was the blunder letting Copilot tell me that that was hard-coded? Because that is one of these hallucinations. It is not true. Here is my Windows 10 laptop, which is enrolled in the ESU program, as you can see on the right there. And you can see that it says that I am up to date, not security things are missing or patches need to be fixed. I'm up to date, so the system is working. And so that I'm sure that's an AI hallucination. So there you go. We're just about 2 minutes away from end of life here, so I'm going to skip ahead, and I need to go to about 69, let's see. Nope, not 69. This one. All right. I skipped over two or three of Chris's things there. Save his voice. We'll come back to those next week. But we don't have time for any other questions, so let's just go straight into the upcoming presentations from the Ottawa Public Library. Tomorrow at Rosemount Branch at 6 o'clock, Linda is going to be talking about basic photo editing. And then if you want to go to the Baltics in your armchair, or at least in the Orleans Library Branch armchair, on Friday the 20th at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, Linda is doing her armchair travel Baltics presentation. And then the final one I have for this week is on February 23rd, Monday, assuming Chris has got his voice back 100%, at 6 o'clock he's doing the Artificial Intelligence Fun and Useful Tips. You'll notice here that this event, according to the library, is full and its waiting list is full. However, as usual, Chris will tell you that there are always no-shows at library presentations, that people register but then they don't turn up. So if you show up at the door, I'm sure Chris will find you a chair.
And at Carlingwood, nobody takes attendance.
Nobody takes attendance. Okay. a bonus presentation. Linda had done one recently on some aspect of photography, I think. This time she's going to be doing one of her armchair travel presentations on beautiful British Columbia, and it's coming up on Tuesday, March the 3rd. Note the starting time. It will start at 7 p.m., which is different from our normal starting time of 7:30. So if you arrive at 7:30 for the British beautiful Columbia, you'll be halfway down the province. I guess in future presentations, Lynn's going to revert to 7:30, but for this particular one, 7 o'clock. And there's the URL. It's being run by us. It's not a library presentation, this one. Run by the PC User Group, so it's completely open. Just click on the link and join us at the appointed time. A couple of things I have as wrap-ups here. For members only, there are a couple of things that we have that are only available to members. One is the members-only forum. This is a Google group, which is available any time of the day, every day of the year. It's like I say, it's an always-on Q&A. If you're a member of the user group and you have subscribed to this forum, then you can post questions or anything or any topic of general interest to this forum. And generally, people are actively monitoring this thing throughout the day. Generally, you'll get some kind of reply to your question in short order. However, this is one of these groups that's only available to PCU members. Interestingly enough, only about a third of the membership take advantage of this. It blows my mind. It's a really useful feature. So if you are a member and you haven't signed on, I would encourage you to go to that URL at the bottom there and find out how to subscribe. If you have questions, if you have problems on your computer that don't fit into Q&A and don't fit into the members forum, the other thing you can do is try for our one-on-one remote assistance program. So you send an email outlining your problem. We send that out to a group of people who volunteered to help. And if somebody can provide assistance, then they do that by using Quick Assist or Zoom to remotely access your computer and find out what's going on. And again, that's only available to members. And the final thing I have for only members is APCUG Wednesday workshops and Saturday safaris. They're available, but again, only to members. So you have to register for those with APCUG and tell them that you're a member of the group. If you're not a member of the group, if you are a member of the group, don't do anything. Your membership is going to be extended for an extra year. But if you're not a member of the group, then we have a special offer where you can pay us for your 2026-27 membership year. The annual fee for that is $20. And out of the goodness of our hearts, we will give you a second membership year absolutely free. So for $20, you get 2 years membership in OPCUG. A deal not to be missed. And only until March the 31st. Okay. We're a few minutes over time, so let me just remind you that next Wednesday, February the 25th, will be our next Q&A session. If you have questions, if you have answers to the questions I've posed tonight, or if you have topics that you'd like to share, send us some information to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we'll be more than happy to add you to next week's agenda. And next week, Chris will be doing all of the talking, and I will just sit quietly in the background. Okay, so thank you very much, everybody. I hope you found it interesting. I hope I didn't bore you to death with work. And we'll see you all next Wednesday.
Just before we close up the call, if the person is on the call who asked about reading a PST file, Serge Eric posted into the chat, MailStore Home can read PST files and it's free. And he included the URL for that. So we'll be sure to include that next week as a follow-up or whatever. But if you want to check that out, check the chat right now, and you can check that URL. thanks, folks, and a big thanks to Alan for taking on the load of the work today.